The world is supported by Wise, the smart new way to move money internationally. Imagine a world where you could speak any language, travel to any place, and spend in any currency with ease. At Wise, they're building the money part. Wise is the world's most international account. It lets you hold and convert dozens of currencies all in one place. And you always get the real exchange rate with no markups like the banks sometimes give you. So whether you're sending money to Australia, hopping on a plane to Poland, or getting paid from France, Wise is all you need. Designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
A tense standoff along the Rio Grande in Texas, thousands of Haitians seeking asylum and food, U.S. border guards are cracking down.
Those who were midway through the river, they tried to block them from getting up onto the bank of the river on the U.S. side.
Washington is now sending plane loads of would-be asylum seekers back to Haiti. Also today, Afghans have typically been welcomed in Turkey. That is changing.
The moment that they find out that you're an Afghan, it gets very difficult.
And the sound of great connectivity in the virtual classroom.
Nunca seré primero, soy un viento extranjero, que también pasa y sueña libre.
How Uruguay nailed the all-remote pandemic choir and online learning. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for being here. It is a desperate scene under a bridge in a small Texas border town. U.S. authorities, including some on horseback, are turning away thousands of mostly Haitian migrants and preventing others from crossing the border from Mexico. U.S. officials have flown hundreds of the migrants back to their homeland. El Paso Times reporter Martha Piskowski has been watching developments from both sides of the border. She says the situation became especially tense yesterday afternoon.
People have been crossing back and forth with food, and then more and more Border Patrol were gathering on the other side. And at a certain point, one of them shouted, 10 minutes, you have 10 minutes. And then they were just shouting at people to get out of the river. Those who were midway through the river, they tried to block them from getting up onto the bank of the river on the U.S. side. And at that point, several of them did charge on their horses, and it felt very close to physical violence.
What is the latest you've seen in this area, Martha, that separates Ciudad Acuña, Mexico, from Del Rio, Texas?
So the situation has been building over the past week. 14,000 people are congregated under this bridge. They don't have enough food or water. They don't have anywhere to sleep. It's been in the high 90s all week. And for that reason, they've been going back over to Ciudad Acuña in Mexico to get food and water. On Sunday, we saw a clear breaking point. Yesterday, U.S. Border Patrol was doing everything in their power to shut down that transit across the river, compelling people to stay in the encampment. So we saw some tense scenes play out as it's mostly Haitians who are in the encampment as they were crossing, buying food and water in Mexico and trying to get back and being confronted by mounted Border Patrol.
So as you said, Martha, many of the migrants are Haitians. I understand that many of them left their country, though, months or even years ago. Is it possible to generalize about why many of them left Haiti in the first place?
A lot of them left when Brazil and Chile were offering work visas to Haitians. And in the years since then, they found it very difficult to integrate into those South American countries. But everyone I spoke to said they really didn't want to go back to Haiti. There was just another earthquake. The president was assassinated a couple months ago, and they're very worried about their prospects if they're sent back.
Are U.S. authorities providing any assistance to the thousands of people in Del Rio?
They say they are providing food, water, that there are EMTs on hand. I think the sheer number of people there has stressed their capacities. But we also, as journalists, have not been able to access the encampment. So it's difficult to ascertain the situation. Some people have been getting photos, you know, sent to them by people staying there. But that's kind of the best we have.
What is your sense, Martha, of how local residents on both sides of the border see the situation?
I spoke with a range of people. The border closure, so since Friday night, the border crossing between Del Rio and Ciudad Acuña has been closed. No one can go back and forth. That has a big impact on local business and just the people of these two cities that are very linked. So I think that has added to some of the frustration. Other people I spoke to said, you know, they understand that these Haitians are coming from a very difficult situation and they seemed sympathetic. But as the situation drags on, I think their reception on the border is not going to last forever.
What comes next? What are people saying?
You know, yesterday, the Haitians I spoke with just seemed really at a loss for what to do. They've spent so much money and time to get here, but knowing that they could be deported, there is a lot of fear. So people I spoke with were just sort of waiting it out and may try to pursue staying in Mexico, but are just hoping for some sort of alternative to come through.
That's Martha Piskowski, a reporter with the El Paso Times. She's been speaking with us about the thousands of migrants, many of them Haitians, gathered along the border in Del Rio, Texas, hoping to open asylum claims. Martha, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.
In Afghanistan, the Taliban have said students can go back to school again, just not high school girls. So far, the Taliban have no clear guidelines for them. Many see this as a strong sign that the Taliban are once again looking to erase women and girls from public life. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
16-year-old Marsal was asleep when the news broke last Friday. When she woke up, her sister rushed to tell her. Have you heard? She asked. Schools are open again. Marsal sat up, excited. After all, it's been weeks since her school shut down because of the pandemic and the war. This was welcome news. But her joy was short-lived. The Taliban have instructed boys from grades 7 to 12 to go back to school, but they made no mention of girls. Marsal says no one had ever told her she can't study. She cried for hours, she told me over a call. She asked that I only use her first name because she worries about speaking critically of the Taliban. She said, I want to know, why is it that boys can go back to school and follow their dreams and I can't? Marsal's dream is to become a graphic designer. She only has 1 year left of high school. Now, she says, everything is on hold. Another student, Nasiba, who's 10, says the Taliban can't just imprison women and girls at home. They must understand that this country won't prosper without women, she says. Nasiba wants to become a doctor, and she says she doesn't want to study at home. I want to be with my friends and teachers, she says. I want to be brave. The Taliban's announcement shocked many in Afghanistan. Over the weekend, there were small protests in cities like Kabul and Herat in the western parts of the country. They were small because the Taliban have been punishing protesters. They have arrested and flogged them in public. You took away my country, the women in Herat city chanted. Don't take away my studies, too. The situation is very upsetting, one school principal in Kabul told me. They are silencing and eliminating Afghan women from public life, she says. The principal asked that I not use her name because she worries about retribution from the Taliban. Normally, she oversees 8,000 students in Kabul. Middle and high school girls make up 6,000 of them, she says. Her students have been calling her, trying to make sense of what is happening. She tells them to be patient as she wipes away her own tears. The principal has four daughters. One of them came to visit her on Friday. Her daughter told her, Mom, if I leave Afghanistan, I don't ever want to come back. This country places no value on me as a woman. Her daughter's words were really painful, she says. The Taliban did respond to questions about why teenage girls can't go back to class. A member of the group's cultural commission came on Afghan television to explain.
He
He said the Taliban haven't banned teenage girls from school. There are just some technical issues that need to be solved first. But many Afghans say they just don't buy this. Friday's news is the latest in a series of moves by the Taliban that have sidelined women. Since they took power last month, they have disbanded the Ministry of Women's Affairs and replaced it with the Ministry of Vice and Virtue. They told female employees to stay home, and they segregated universities by gender. All this is in line with the brutal way the Taliban governed Afghanistan the last time they were in power. Everything has changed, the principal says. We have gone back to the 1990s. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Russians went to the polls this weekend. Not surprisingly, Russian President Vladimir Putin's ruling party, United Russia, came out on top. Across Russia, there were complaints of vote rigging in favor of Putin's party. Russian opposition activists are calling the election a sham. The World's Daniel Offman has been following these elections closely. And top line here, Daniel, what occurs to you at the conclusion of the Russian Duma elections?
Well, as you said, Marco, what's not surprising is that Putin's ruling party, United Russia, maintains control. The second thing that jumped out is reports across Russia of falsification, ballot stuffing, and basically straight-up election rigging. And finally, there was a huge outcry, at least amongst the Russian opposition, that U.S. tech companies, Apple and Google, removed apps that were set up by the Russian opposition. So essentially, these companies caved under Kremlin pressure.
Yeah, all of that is eye-grabbing. Let's start with the election rigging. What have you seen?
So this starts even before the actual election days started. Leading up to the election, scores of independent candidates and opposition figures were barred from even running, from participating in the election. Over the weekend, we saw a number of other concerning issues. There were scores of videos circulating on social media of actual ballot stuffing. And we saw other reports of people essentially being forced to vote. And that applies mostly to military personnel, government workers, and others who rely on state budget for their income. And also, we saw Russia introduced e-voting in some regions across the country, and many have alleged that this is yet another tool the Kremlin is using for falsifying the election results. Here's what political analyst Konstantin Eger told me about e-voting in Russia.
It's very simple. Whenever the Kremlin cooks up some new idea, it is always to deceive, to lie, and it is always to the benefit of the Kremlin.
Yeah, well, that's a cynical view, but not without ample evidence. Daniel, you mentioned how Apple and Google played a part in this Duma election. What apps did they remove, and how have people in Russia been reacting to that?
So this starts with Alexei Navalny. He, of course, is the anti-Putin opposition leader in Russia. He's been in prison on trumped-up charges. But his organization, his political team, devised a strategic plan called Smart Voting. Basically, it's a protest vote, pooling together votes for a candidate who has the highest chance of challenging a Putin candidate, a United Russia candidate. But we saw that Apple and Google have blocked these apps. And I spoke with Russian journalist and political analyst Mikhail Fishman, and this was his conclusion.
Russian independent voices can no longer rely on big tech. The big tech finally succumbed to Kremlin's pressure.
So, Daniel, how do we explain this? Why did Apple and Google remove this content? I mean, did they finally cave, as Fishman indicated?
So Apple and Google have not yet commented publicly on this issue. Russia's government sees Navalny's organization and, by extension, these apps as illegal. There are some reports that the companies were threatened with fines and even legal action from the Kremlin if these apps were not removed.
So we're looking at United Russia, Putin's party, now with a majority in parliament. This is not a surprise. What does this mean, though, looking ahead into Russia's political future?
As you said, Marco, not a surprise that Putin's party, United Russia, came out on top. And Russian people do understand that there was rigging and falsifying going on with this election. But what this does do, it still gives Putin's party some legitimacy. They are less popular than they used to be, but many Russians believe that even without the rigging, even without falsifying, Putin still has a mandate to lead in Russia. Here's political analyst Konstantin Egert again.
It is not about 2021, and it's not even about the Duma. It is all about Putin and his future.
So in the long term, this election is almost like a trial run. It gives Putin time to decide what to do in 2024. That's when his presidential term ends. And the big question being, will Putin run again, or will he finally look for a successor?
The World's Daniel Hoffman speaking with us about the results of Russia's parliamentary Duma election. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thanks, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's not often that a real-life hero portrayed in a film turns into a bad guy, but that seems to have been what's happened in Rwanda, at least according to the government there. Paul Rusesabagina was portrayed as the hero of the film Hotel Rwanda, a man who sheltered more than 1,200 people in a hotel he managed during Rwanda's genocide. Today, Rusesabagina was found guilty on counts of treason, terrorism, and murder. Journalist Michaela Wrong has been following the trial and joins us from London. Michaela, first, if you would, remind us of the basics of this case.
Well, Paul Rusesabagina was an ordinary man who emerged as a hero as people began to record what had happened during the genocide. And then eventually we were to see a Hollywood film. The interesting thing was he went from playing this quietly heroic role, then having it commemorated in this way, and then becoming a sort of center of attention and becoming a de facto human rights advocate and becoming more and more critical of Kagame's regime.
Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda.
Yes, that's right. And he began to see more and more similarities between the new regime, which, of course, was run by a Tutsi-dominated rebel, former rebel group, and the regime that it had replaced, and said so because he had a platform. And this didn't make him very popular. So in 1996, he fled the country and then eventually ended up moving to the States. But he did run this very vocal foundation from America, which was highlighting the increasingly sort of unappetizing human rights record of Paul Kagame's government.
We should also mention how he ended up back in Rwanda for this trial.
More than a year ago, we suddenly heard reports he had gone rather mysteriously to Dubai, and it turned out that he had been lured onto a private jet, and he was lured onto that flight, which then, instead of flying to Bujumbura in Burundi, as he was expecting, landed in Kigali, and there he was immediately arrested and then charged with all these 9 counts of terrorism.
So the whole backstory that you describe, Michaela, to the trial makes one question, what's behind the guilty verdict for Mr. Rusesabagina? What has been the reaction to this verdict from Rusesabagina and his lawyers? What have you heard?
The trouble with this trial is that quite early on in March, Rusesabagina decided not to attend. He said he would not take part in it because it was a sham trial. His lawyers were not going to be presenting evidence because he wasn't able to see them. And in fact, there has been a long litany of complaints by his legal team. All sorts of sort of legal procedures had been violated. But it has also seen Rwanda's reputation for judicial impartiality, I think, has taken a knock.
What are ordinary Rwandans saying about the trial?
It's really very hard to know what public opinion in Rwanda is. The elections, for example, don't convey with any accuracy what people would like to vote. You know, we have Kagame winning the last presidential elections with 99% of the vote. So it's a very closely monitored, very tight country where people feel that they've been constantly watched and followed and sort of listened to. And I think in those circumstances, it's really hard to know. I imagine that people who are critics of the government, even if they're just silent critics, will be very dispirited by this outcome. Because, of course, the message it sends out to them is no matter how important you are, how many important friends you have in Hollywood, how far away you've moved, we can find you and bring you back and make you accountable if we decide to.
Legally, what comes next in the process? Will there be a sentencing? Will Rusesabagina appeal?
He's just been given a 25-year sentence, which, of course, could have been longer. It could have been a life sentence. But if you are 67 years old and you're suffering from high blood pressure, as someone who has recovered from cancer, a 25-year sentence is effectively going to be a life sentence. We have seen previous high-profile political cases of this sort in the past, where the individual concerned got fairly heavy sentences and were then released under presidential pardon. They are then forced to sort of hand in their passports, their movements are monitored, they have to report to the authorities on a regular basis. But it's hard to know if Kagame will make that kind of gesture. I don't think he will make it immediately.
As you said, Michaela, Rusesabagina moved to Belgium in 1996, became a Belgian citizen. How's the Belgian government responding to the verdict?
The lawyers who represented Rusesabagina have pointed out that the Belgian prosecutors, who had an open investigation going into Rusesabagina, that they were cooperating with the Rwandans and giving them lots of material that was then cited in court as being important and part of the prosecution case that convinced the judges. So it seems that the Belgians played a facilitating role, but they are now also criticizing the outcome.
Writer and journalist Michaela Rong has been following the trial of Rwandan dissident Paul Rusesabagina, found guilty today in Rwanda on counts of treason, terrorism, and murder. She's been speaking with us from London. Michaela, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
If you know of the Senegalese band Orchestra Baobab, you probably know of their lead guitarist, Barthélemy Atiso. Sadly, we got the news recently that he died at his home in Togo in West Africa at the age of 76. Atiso did not set out to become a virtuoso improviser on the guitar. He went from Togo to Senegal to study law in 1966 and picked up the guitar to make some extra money. The instrument came naturally, and soon he was sitting in with the house band at one of Dakar's famous night spots, the Miami Club. He got offered a solo gig, one thing led to another, and when his partners in the house band started their own ensemble, Orchestra Baobab, they offered Barthélemy Atiso the job as lead guitarist. Baobab became world-famous, virtual ambassadors for Senegal, but Atiso never forgot his home of Togo, where he returned to, not just to live, but to continue his practice as a lawyer, a successful musician who kept his day job. World stages one day, contracts and divorces the next. We pay homage today to Barthélemy Atiso with one of his smoldering guitar solos. This is Boul Mamine. Recently, late guitarist Barthélemy Atiso taking his solo there with his ensemble, Orchestra Baobab from Senegal. You are listening to The World. Germans head to the polls this weekend, where the far right is stealing a page from the Trump playbook, claiming vote tampering with no proof.
There were even talks about a Dominion voting system who supposedly changed votes.
Sounds familiar. One glaring problem with the machine tampering claim in Germany, Germans vote on paper. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. If there are some angry exchanges on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly meeting in New York this week, don't be surprised. I'm thinking specifically the diplomatic fallout between the U.S. and its oldest ally. On Friday, France recalled its ambassadors from the U.S. and Australia. This followed an announcement from the two countries and the United Kingdom that the three signed a new Indo-Pacific security pact and excluded the French. It's the first time France has ever recalled its ambassador from Washington. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry joins me now. So the French are angry not least because this security deal meant that a French-Australian deal on submarines was scrapped. How serious is this?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, Marco. Certainly the French aren't short of using superlatives to describe how badly they feel that they've been treated. We saw the French foreign minister saying last week the move was a stab in the back and the kind of behaviour you would expect from President Trump. Then over the weekend, the same foreign minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, he was on French TV and saying that France had met repeatedly with representatives from the US and Australia in the last few months, including Anthony Blinken and Joe Biden, and no one had breathed a word of this. And he said, this is why we had to take the action that we did.
Il y a eu mensonge, il y a eu duplicité, Il y a eu rupture majeure de confiance.
So he said there's been a lie, there's been duplicity, there's been a major breach of trust, there's been contempt, so it's not okay between us, it's not okay, he said. But White House officials are today being quoted as saying that they expect relations will improve, that they expect the French ambassador to the US to return to his role within a week. And we do know that President Biden and Emmanuel Macron are due to meet, are due to speak, I should say, on the phone later this week. And the French are at pains to point out that it was the US who asked for the call to be made.
Mm. So, Orla, if France recalled ambassadors from the US and Australia, why not Britain?
Well, the way the French are playing it is that Britain is insignificant in all of this. The same French foreign minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, said Great Britain is a bit of a fifth wheel on the carriage, as he put it, and that Boris Johnson is just happy to be along for the ride, which is a bit of a snub at Britain because Britain has been quite intent on repositioning itself on the global stage following Brexit, and this alliance is seen to be reflective of that. I should say the French have taken one form of action against the UK. There was a defence summit scheduled this week between the French and British defence ministers, and that's now been cancelled. But we had Boris Johnson once again in the last 24 hours talking up his relationship with the French. He was on the flight to New York heading to the UN General Assembly meeting, and he said to reporters, our love of France is ineradicable, is how he described it.
Mm, and yet the UK is part of this new alliance with Australia and the US, the AUKUS alliance. Britain, however, is no longer part of the European Union, of course. Brexit saw to that. But France is very much in the EU. So what does this all mean for the European Union?
There's been a lot of talk of this in the last few days, that this is a wake-up call for the European Union and that its role has been weakened by this alliance. But I asked Jakob Kierkegaard of the German Marshall Fund about this earlier.
There's a lot of people in Brussels who would like the EU to be a political and military superpower. Well, it's not. And the member states of the EU has fairly deliberately chosen not to be that. They simply don't spend enough money on defense. You know, this notion that, oh my God, I'm shocked. You know, there's gambling in Casablanca. The EU is not a geopolitical superpower. Well, it's not. No. And so what?
And as Kierkegaard said, the EU's position is unlikely to change because most EU leaders have little interest in spending more on defense, no matter what alliance the US draws up with a European country.
So Australia has now walked away from the submarine deal with France. Today, it's also being reported that a new free trade agreement between the EU and Australia is now in jeopardy. How likely is it, Orla, that that deal will end up falling apart?
Yeah, that remains to be seen. This came following comments by France's European Affairs Minister in the last couple of days, Clément Beaune. He said he couldn't see how Australia could now be trusted in terms of trade negotiations. And we did see the Australian Trade Minister coming out this morning saying quite the opposite. He said it's all very much business as usual in terms of negotiations, that they are proceeding. But then this afternoon, the EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said, look, one of our member states has been treated in a way that isn't acceptable. The situation has to be clarified before you keep on going with business as usual. But of course, moods may have lifted this afternoon with the news of the US lifting its travel ban on fully vaccinated EU travellers.
The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
About that travel ban Orla just mentioned, the White House said today it's lifting coronavirus restrictions for many fully vaccinated international travelers starting in November. That will, for the first time in more than a year, open U.S. borders to travelers from Europe as well as China and some other places. Starting in November, foreign nationals will need to show proof of vaccination along with a negative COVID test before hopping on a plane bound for the U.S. The White House said the decision follows the science. Some do see political pressure at play. The Biden administration has been taking a lot of heat from European leaders, businesses, and airlines. For months, American travelers have been allowed to visit Europe, but hopeful European passengers could not fly in the other direction. European leaders had been hoping since June that President Biden would reciprocate Europe's policy. Today, they got their wish. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson tweeted out today, it's a fantastic boost for business and trade, and quote, great that family and friends on both sides of the pond can be reunited once again, end quote. Germans head to the polls next weekend to decide who will succeed long-serving Chancellor Angela Merkel. The German political system may be unfamiliar to many Americans. For example, voters there indirectly elect their chancellor by casting ballots for parliamentary candidates and their party of choice. But something that we have been seeing recently with elections in the U.S. is now playing out in Germany. From Berlin, Emma Hurt has our story.
This video went minorly viral on German social media. A man is showing what he claims to be a sealed ballot box. He says he's demonstrating how it's allegedly possible to open this ballot box with two kitchen knives without breaking the seal. This is something German election officials have firmly denied.
So ist Wahlbetrug in Deutschland möglich. Bitte weiterleiten und teilen. Danke.
So election fraud is possible in Germany. Please forward and share, he says. It's a different language, a different country, but somehow the same. In the U.S., video upon debunked video appeared after the 2020 election, alleging various false scenarios of ballots being miscounted or tampered with. There was no actual evidence of widespread fraud, but still, a Monmouth poll last November found more than 40% of Americans weren't fully confident about the accuracy of the vote count, and some of that distrust seeped beyond U.S. borders and has been increasing ahead of Germany's national elections on Sunday.
We've seen that after the election in the U.S., it never really stopped.
Miro Dittrich studies far-right activity on the internet for a German nonprofit, the Center for Monitoring, Analysis, and Strategy.
The far-right and conspiracy ideologues in Germany very closely monitored the situation in the U.S. Around the supposed voter fraud that was happening there, and they clearly saw it as a winning campaign for them.
A cross-pollination of disinformation was especially evident in June during the elections in one eastern German state, Saxony-Anhalt. After a right-wing party, the AfD, did not perform as well as some polls had predicted, Dittrich says election fraud claims spread, some of them directly copied from the U.S.
There were even talks about a Dominion voting system who supposedly changed votes, although we don't have any voting machines here, and of course Dominion isn't working here.
In Germany, all votes are cast on paper ballots that must be received by 6 p.m. on Sunday. The June elections in Saxony-Anhalt were a bellwether case study of what could happen after Sunday's national election, says Helena Schwertheim, a researcher with ISD Global, a think tank that monitors hate speech, extremism, and disinformation.
Election fraud are being promoted by far-right politicians and influencers. Within 24 hours, for example, this hashtag of Wahlbetrug, which is election fraud in English, was identified being used on Twitter almost 5,000 times. So we see really this amplification of this narrative and unnecessary worry about this kind of fraudulent behavior as well.
While there have been fraud claims in past German elections, Schwertheim says something is new this time around, distrust of vote by mail. Some leaders of the AfD and a new right-wing party, Die Basis, have urged their supporters to only vote in person. They held a rally in Berlin recently. Alexandra Motschmann is a Die Basis parliament candidate from Bavaria.
In my opinion, it's better if you go to the election hall and vote there instead of just posting your votes via envelope.
When asked, she didn't cite any evidence as to why the system might be vulnerable. Germany has used vote by mail since 1957 without incident, but officials expect usage could double this year. To be clear, Schwertheim with ISD says Germany is not seeing the same scale of disinformation as the U.S., where a sitting president repeatedly questioned the integrity of the system.
Largely speaking, if you were to compare it to the U.S. context and the narrative on online election fraud in the 2020 elections and the outfall there, you really can't compare it.
The highest profile elected officials talking about this in Germany are from the AfD, which has just 12% of the seats in parliament. But Miro Dittrich says the situation indicates that what might seem like an American problem has broader implications.
These alternative realities that are created in the United States and are really popular there have a huge impact on countries that the U.S. is allied with. And them not dealing with these problems in the right way has huge consequences for us.
Germany's top election official has said he sees no chance of a similar election fraud crisis in his country. But still, his office has maintained a fake news webpage, debunking false claim after false claim. For The World, I'm Emma Hurt in Berlin.
As hard as the pandemic has been on you parents with school-aged children, imagine what it'd be like in an age without modern technology. Virtual education saved what could have been many months of lost learning. The pandemic, as we know, also exposed deep social and economic inequalities. Access to computers and the internet varied wildly across the U.S. and the globe. For a model of technological success, look at Uruguay. It developed a plan almost 15 years ago that gave students a massive head start. Reporter Valeria Fernandez tells us how Plan Ceibal became a lifeline for some students.
Martina Vázquez is my cousin in Uruguay. I asked her to show me how virtual learning worked for her this past year.
Y acá está el PowerPoint que mandó mi profesora.
Martina is 13, and she loved how she could keep track of every single assignment at a glance. And if she was lost, she could go back and review recorded classes.
Bueno, entonces fijamos el escrito para ciencias físicas, ¿les parece?
Like this physics class, where the instructor is trying to set up a time for an exam. Sometimes the internet will glitch and kick her from class, and she will worry the instructor will think she was playing hooky. Since she was 7, Martina received a tablet from the Uruguayan public school system, and then later, a computer. It's all part of a program called Plan Ceibal, which started in 2007. The idea was to put devices in the hands of every public school student to bridge the digital divide. This is the only computer in her household.
Nos sirve para muchas cosas, no solamente para la escuela y eso, sino que y el liceo. Y
it's useful for many things, not just school and high school, says Martina. My mom uses it, we all use it. It is helpful for day-to-day things. So when the pandemic hit, most Uruguayan students in public education already had a Plan Ceibal computer.
But the culture of virtual education was not there.
That's Leandro Folgar, the current president of Plan Ceibal. In March 2020, his agency had to quickly switch gears to transition fully to virtual education. They chose to use one centralized platform that already existed, called CREA, that had video conferencing software embedded, assignments, grading capabilities, and ways to share homework, all in one. The strategy was
to guarantee the connection, the contact between students and teachers.
During the first few weeks, only 75% of the students joined virtual classes. So Plan Ceibal and other agencies created a TV program.
Bienvenidos y bienvenidas a un nuevo programa de Tiempo de Aprender. Hoy es viernes.
The idea was to redirect the students to online platforms, and it worked. Over 85% of students and teachers in public schools from primary to secondary education use the virtual platform. That's more than 606,000 users in a country of over 3.4 million people. But it wasn't without its challenges. Internet connectivity was still a problem for students in rural areas and for those who couldn't afford data plans. Part of the solution, says Folgar, was negotiating with internet providers to free traffic for education.
They weren't paying any money or they weren't using the gigabytes of their home plan, let's say.
If they didn't have internet service at all, students could connect in their school. But in almost half of the households, the only computer available was from Plan Ceibal. Many parents also had to use it for work amidst an economic crisis.
I mean, the virtual education that was happening in Uruguay was possible, but it wasn't optimal or great or enjoyable in any way.
But there was joy. Students from 5 different middle schools and high schools are led by instructor Karina Techera. It sounds like they're all together, but each of their voices were recorded separately. With the help of students, Techera weaved the sound and images together in a video.
Cuando llega la pandemia y dijimos, ay, no vamos a poder cantar. Fue terrible.
When the pandemic started, says Techera, we thought we wouldn't be able to sing. It was terrible. She and other instructors thought of ways to keep choirs alive. Since it was impossible to sing together, they have conversations during video classes on the CREA platform, and then she'd coach them one-on-one. They send audio recordings via WhatsApp. And like other classes, choir wasn't an obligation. When students miss class, Techera will find out later that they struggle with depression, death of a family member, or financial troubles at home. Choir was a lifeline.
Y que había muchas ganas de volver a vernos, de volver a abrazarnos y a compartir.
We really wanted to see each other again, says Techera. When everybody was having a bad day, they would start writing her rap.
Nosotros opinamos, por eso garantizamos que si sueñas, te juro que lo logramos.
Techera's choirs reunited in person when students went back to school in Uruguay in June. The technology was important, but it was the human will to connect, says Techera, that made it work and could lead the path forward to more innovations.
Sigue estudiando y cuida tu vida. Vamos que se puede apostar un nuevo día.
For the World, I'm Valeria Fernandez.
For years, Turkey was generally welcoming to people from Afghanistan, but over the past year, Turkish attitudes have changed. As Fariba Nawa reports from Istanbul, discrimination is on the rise. And a note, some people in the story asked to not use their full names for fear of their safety.
Since the Taliban seized control of Afghanistan, more of my Afghan friends are trying to make Istanbul a home. My apartment has become a place to gather and seek comfort in each other. At brunch at my house, several of us eat spicy eggs and tomatoes. My friends with Afghan passports face an uphill battle with Turkish bureaucracy and a heightened prejudice with the Turkish public.
Before, Turks would not say things directly. Now they say it. Why are Afghans coming here? Why don't you have a homeland? And why are you not going back and fighting back?
Sarah's 19 years old. Her family fled Kabul 4 years ago because her father was getting death threats as a public defender. They crossed the Iranian border with smugglers and were able to register as refugees. But Turkey sends refugees to smaller towns because the government says the cities are too crowded. Sarah's high school classmates made fun of her for speaking Farsi. She says the principal stood up to the bullies and she made some Turkish friends. Many Turks were kind and welcoming. But that's changing, Sarah says.
A week ago, when I went with my aunt to a hospital, a Turkish woman attacked me. On the subject of why are Afghans coming here and all the foreigners are coming to Turkey and taking Turkish money, I was so shocked that I didn't know what to say to her.
Registered refugees have access to public schooling and discounted health care, but they have no right to work and no cash aid. Nearly half of the 300,000 Afghan refugees are undocumented, and they have no rights to services. Authorities have stepped up raids to deport and detain them. Afghans end up working menial jobs under the table for low wages. When I first moved here in 2015, Turkish cab drivers would tell me they like Afghans but had issues with Syrian refugees. Yet as migration of Afghans rose, Afghans became the new target of racism. This Turkish man is telling the Yurttaş Turkish YouTube channel that he's against refugees in Turkey.
Life was much better in 2010-2011. Then the Syrians came and life became much more expensive.
Among the several people Yurttaş interviewed on Istanbul's streets, only one elderly man supported refugees. We're all human, he says. They're running from death. What does God say? He says when people take refuge with you, protect them. Turkish polls show that the majority wants borders closed to refugees. Several months ago, Turkish media showed lines of Afghans walking through the mountains of Iran towards the Turkish border. But migration in the last month has dwindled. In part, that's because a 10-foot wall on Turkey's border with Syria and Iraq has now been extended across the border with Iran. Meanwhile, Afghans within Turkey are politically divided. Last year in Istanbul, a group of Afghan men raised a white Taliban flag in a standoff with another group raising the colorful Afghan national flag. The Taliban flag sent Turkish social media into a frenzy that Afghan terrorists were in Turkey. That was in Zeytinburnu, a lively neighborhood where Afghans settled decades ago and new refugees find a support network or another smuggler to take them to Europe.
Assalamu alaikum.
Here I meet Idris Attar, an Afghan businessman who helps run a federation for Afghans. He blames Afghan men for some of the rising discrimination.
Afghans did some bad things. They raped a young girl in Zeytinburnu. They formed a gang of thieves. They tied up an Iranian woman and stole from her. That's when Turks started to become anxious and say, we can't go to our parks without harassment from Afghans.
Attar says that a few incidents cannot be held against an entire population. But he says Afghan men in particular have to change their sexist behaviors if they want a welcome wagon in Turkey. There's been pressure on Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to crack down on migration. He said Afghans do not belong in Turkey. One concern among the nationalist parties is that refugees are bolstering a conservative interpretation of Islam in Turkey, and they believe part of that is a mindset against women. Sociologist Shebnem Kosher Akçapar studies migration here.
Many women are feeling uneasy because it's a male-dominated migration and there are incidents of sexual assault and even rape. Some segments of the society are afraid because they think that the ethnic and religious composition of the country will change.
Back in my apartment after brunch, Sarah is searching online for a home for our friend Farzana. But it's not an easy task. Turkish landlords flat out say in text messages that they don't want to rent to foreigners.
When I saw that message, I got angry and so disappointed because Istanbul has been one of my favorite cities around the world. And I really wanted to live here. But this is something I'm experiencing right now. To know that the moment they find out that you're an Afghan, and it gets very difficult.
Farzana is a renowned Afghan photographer and is expecting her European or Canadian visa. But for Sarah, it's going to be a long wait to receive asylum to another country.
I hope to go somewhere I can continue my studies, where I can legally work and faceless prejudice.
In the meantime, she says she's going to confront any more discrimination with her fluent Turkish and her kind smile. For the World, Fariba Nawa in Istanbul.
And that will do it for this Monday edition of the show. If you want to hear from us earlier in the day, you can sign up for our daily newsletter, Top of the World. You'll get a selection of world headlines sent straight to your inbox every morning. You can sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll be back with you again right here tomorrow.